Hello, it's 2 p.m. on Friday afternoon. Welcome to an emergency podcast with me, Dorian Linitsky, plus Roz Taylor and Ian Dunt. Tomorrow, it's the final vote on Johnson's deal and the big people's vote march too. It feels very much like this is the moment of truth, and it's going to be a very long moment of truth. But it's not over till it's over. We are not giving up. So what's going to happen? We will start with the deal. Ian, I've seen some hilarious Scooby-Doo memes in which the mask of Johnson's deal is taken off and it's just the May deal. But obviously it's not exactly. And a lot of people thought he wasn't even going to get a deal. What do you think he sort of achieved? What's substantially different?
Yeah, well, first of all, he got a deal, which I think loads of us... I mean, I was not thinking that was the direction that we were traveling.
We weren't even
in,
sure if he wanted...
Well, exactly.
Yeah. I always thought he wanted to deal.
Yeah, I think he did say once or twice. And we've had others as well. There's a couple of people out there who always thought this is a strategy.
10 points for Rosendor.
Indeed. But I think it's... You don't know... I mean, I don't think that at any point it was necessarily true that he was definitely going for it or definitely going for something else. It's just the way that it pans out at a certain time. In fact, some of the reports this morning suggest that that phone call with Merkel paradoxically, you know, that they lost their shit over like a week ago, paradoxically shifted him into accepting the Northern Ireland. We don't know. And we don't know whether it was a plan or the way along. However, he did manage to reopen the withdrawal agreement, which for a long time you said they wouldn't do. And lots of us sort of said, well, look, they won't do it. And he has managed to change the backstop. So on that stuff, there is no way of getting around that fact that was stuff that we didn't think was doable, that has in fact proved doable. However, that should not colour us too much to just how much he's capitulated on the items that the EU has put forward for him. And those have quite severe consequences, not just for the UK and for, I think, the future constitutional arrangements, but also for the strategic incentives of both sides of Parliament, of the sort of ERG jihadist types and of the more moderate sort of purge Tories and Labour pro-deal guys.
And did the EU make any major concessions, or was it really on our side?
What kind of concessions have they really made? I mean, because taking it from when they were negotiating with May, this is pretty much what they wanted. I mean, they don't really like the dual customs thing, because in some way that is going to involve the UK sort of policing the EU's border, and it is going to be very, very complicated. So they don't really like that, and they've given on it. It's quite hard to think of much else on VAT, on sort of... I mean, it's hard to think of anything that they really gave in on.
On the fact of reopening the withdrawal agreement, they did, which Juncker said they didn't, but then you can't really rely on Juncker, as I'm sure we'll get onto later, to be entirely consistent.
Donald Tusk's farewell to Britain was very touching, but it also seemed a little...
Oh, it made me crack up again. I'm sorry. It just always does whenever he says something like that. And I have to stop because I get too sad.
He's like somebody at the end of a movie just sort of letting someone... It's not like Rick in Casablanca letting her get on the plane.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like that. But it's worse. I've never really been touched by Casablanca, but I am by Donald Tusk.
Some would say that given the sort of length of the deal and the complexity of it, that perhaps shouldn't be giving people... a couple of days to read it and then, you know, a few hours to pass it or not. I mean, is that just... I mean, obviously, that's suboptimal. But kind of inevitable. I mean, is there a real problem with that? Do you think there are going to be people who are going into the lobbies not really knowing anything beyond the way it's been spun?
Definitely there will be, but I mean, and there's also plenty of MPs, let's not mess around, and no matter how long they were to have with a long, complicated legal document, would not have the capacity to read it, nor the interest in doing so.
I'm imagining Marc Francois like a dog with a newspaper.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Occasionally barking angrily at it. But ultimately, with most of it, the text matters, and the dual custom stuff is just obscenely complicated. And I think very few MPs will be basing it on the sort of minutia of it. What ultimately matters in that document is the manner of trust that you have in where we go next. Okay, and this takes a bit of explaining, right? So before, when you had the backstop, basically what Theresa May was saying was, look, you guys, you Brexiters, you've got all this chance to do these alternative arrangements. And if you fail to do them, the insurance policy kicks in. And the reason they hated it was because they secretly knew that they were never going to be able to do those arrangements and the insurance policy was going to kick in. Now the backstop is gone. It's turned into a front stop. The relationship with Ireland is supposed to be a permanent one. There is a consent lock. There's stuff that can happen in Stormont. Mm. But it's envisioned as a permanent one. Now that changes things because this stuff kicks in basically in a few months. The transition only goes until the end of next year. Now, on that basis, once you get there, you get another no-deal cliff edge. It's not the same as this one. It doesn't involve citizens' rights, it doesn't involve the budget, but it still has the other effects of going, you will fall onto WTO rules. Now, on that basis, you are now going to have ERG guys looking at it, and this is happening right now. This is where the meat of the real issue about tomorrow is happening right now. ERG guys looking at that and going, well, we're pretty assured by Boris Johnson that he's going to go, he's going to try and get a majority, and we'll just be able to force the WTO any Brexit, you know, in a year and a half, because the strategic assessment has changed. And when you look then at the purged Tories, and when you look then at the Labour pro dealers, they'll be looking at that and thinking, actually, is this a deal? Or is this a deferral of the no-deal dynamic for about 18 months?
And he's also counting on being able to get rid of the DUP. What he wants to do is go, of course, for a quick general election in which he will no longer have to depend on the DUP's vote. And it shouldn't be underestimated just how much the DUP dislike this deal. I mean, a pretty anti-DUP academic I was reading yesterday was basically saying he's thrown the DUP under a bus. That may not matter to most people in the rest of Britain, but it matters in Northern Ireland.
Mm. Well, the Brexiters seem to be, the kind of, you know, non-Tory Brexiters seem to be split on this. Farage is like, this isn't, he's sort of no deal or bust, isn't he? He's just like...
Oh, no, you haven't heard, he's a Remainer now.
Yeah.
He's very cross.
Oh, yes, yeah. He's very cross because of the,
he's very
they might not get an extension.
For ruling out the brilliant Benn Act, which, as you know, he's been a huge supporter of for some time. It's actually, to be honest, if this shit is worth anything, it is worth watching Nigel Farage turn his entire political body inside
just
out.
Just because the EU said something.
Well, really, because it's against his interests, right? Like, I mean, imagine if there is an election before a deal is passed, in other words, if this gets rejected and they extend and there's an election, then Brexit Party's got a pretty good shot at causing major damage. If a deal is passed, fucking Brexit Party's as fucked as anyone.
It's fucking hilarious, though, when you think about it. Like, the idea that the Brexit Party, literally called the Brexit Party, wants to kind of, like, stall Brexit in order to serve the electoral interests of the Brexit Party. It's like, mate, the clue is in
whatever
the name.
Whatever means necessary.
But leave.eu took a break from racist bants to actually back the deal. And so presumably this is with Aaron Banks's endorsement. And so that's the first time they've fallen out with Farage, or that... Mm. Certainly recently, because they seem to have come around to, I suppose, what we were saying a long time ago, was that if you were the ERG, Eve.eu, whatever, and thank God, you know, they didn't behave like this, but we were saying, well, you just get it done, right? I mean, I hate that, not a terrible phrase. You would get something passed. You would get Brexit to be seen to have happened. And actually, of course, the reason that it fell was because of the kind of hardline Brexiters going, no, not this kind. So is this like an outbreak of just pragmatism from Leave.eu?
Yeah, I think it is, basically. And also, I think they're taking their cue from Dominic Cummings. It's interesting, I've been hearing things about Cummings and suggesting that Boris Johnson not being quite so much in thrall to Cummings over the past couple of weeks, thinking that he's gone a bit too far with his rhetoric. But on the other hand, that may all just be Machiavellian bullshit. And Cummings may deliberately have seemed to go too far in order that Boris could seem to be in charge. Yeah, I think they ultimately think that this is as much as they can reasonably get away with in the time available now. And they want, Cummings wants to get out of Downing Street by 31st October so he can have his mysterious operation. So it's important that he gets it done.
Maybe they're going to insert his soul.
I think he needs to have his skull expanded to accommodate his enormous brain, because it's very tight
at the
moment.
The scars would show, wouldn't they?
Let's go full Mekon. But of course, I mean, that brings us to one of the problems where we were saved before. We were saved by the ERG, you know, Spartans, and now obviously the numbers and the DUP. And the reason the numbers are dicey now is that a lot of the Spartans, such a stupid name. A lot of the ERG wankers are again taking this pragmatic void. They're saying actually probably we should not thwart Brexit again, and so. Those numbers suddenly get very kind of shaky, and then there's all kinds of trouble among the sort of Labour pro dealers. And it just seems to change each day Ian, could you give us a quick assessment of where the numbers are and who seems likely to go for it of those
great
people?
So I would be expect. I don't know which way it's going to go. I genuinely think this is properly knife edge and 50-50. And in fact, pretty much all the betting markets suggest that. I would be surprised if it was even a double-digit margin of victory for either side. So you've got four key groups that Boris Johnson would be looking for. So he's going for, so let's say ERG, DUP, Purge Tories, Labour Pro Dealers. Okay, so he lost the DUP. And that, I mean, without that, we would now be fucked. Like, this would be a very different emergency podcast because there would be no hope whatsoever. But he lost the DUP. So that takes the 10 votes, but more importantly, it offers a political cover. Now, we thought that would have more effect than it actually has done. But in actual fact, I mean, I would have thought more ERG guys, up to, you know, 12, 15 of them would move. That does not seem to be the case at the moment. At the moment, the ERG seems to be holding pretty firm. So then you look at Purge Tories. And of course, you know, a bunch of Tories have now joined parties like the Lib Dems or others like Dominic Grieve are going to obviously vote against this thing. Others are more, and some definitely will vote for it. So Nicola Soames, for instance, has said, I will always go for a deal. Others are a bit more questionable. Like, I was thinking about Rory Stewart today.
I was thinking about him.
I mean, he wants to run for London mayor, and I would just lightly suggest to you, if you want to be mayor of London, you better have a fucking good story to tell about how you didn't support Boris Johnson's deal. But, you know, whatever, we'll see how that goes. I mean, you look at someone like Philip Hammond, and think potentially also questionable. I mean, Oliver Letwin has said he will definitely vote for the deal, but there are very interesting things going on with him, which we should discuss in a minute. And the Labour MPs are split. We think probably about seven at the moment would go for it. Even Kate Hoey is questionable because Kate Hoey, of course, often goes with the DUP. So we would see how that goes. On the other hand, you know, Caroline Flint, will almost certainly vote for the deal. People like Stephen Kinnock, it's just not clear. Gloria De Piero, not clear. And everything will... I mean, at the moment, the most important group, because it's there's the most numbers that are open to change, are those Labour Pro dealers.
Yeah, can we just dig in to the psychology of the Labour Pro dealers? Because it seems to me, and my role here is basically to be confused man in the street with these simplistic readings of situations that you then complicate, is that... there is absolutely no incentive, because if you are seen to be one of a handful of Labour MPs that gets it over, the line, you are hated within your party. But the story, the top line, which Jo Swinson will of course leap on, is that Labour MPs got it over the line. So also you've really hurt your party, and also you've allowed Boris Johnson to celebrate a major victory. And if he then goes into a next election, going, "I've done the impossible, I've delivered Brexit." Like, it just seems... I literally cannot work out what the incentive is. What hope do these people have? How does Kinnock or Flint think this is going to help their political futures?
I would say there's two reasons, and they're quite powerful, and they may not be very apparent to us sitting in, as we are, in London most of the time, although some of us do occasionally leave it, I think. But the first is that these are often MPs in non-London constituencies, people like Caroline Flint, who are, they tell us, being told repeatedly by their constituents on the doorstep, just get this thing done. I'm so bored of Brexit. And that is bound to have an effect, because listening to your constituents does have an effect. That's why the anti-Brexit campaign is urging everyone to write to their EU, to their MPs today. The other real reason why they're so worried about this is because they really want to move on. They too want to stop talking about Brexit. A lot of them do actually care a lot about issues like austerity, and they think, misguidedly in my opinion, but they think that getting Brexit done, in inverted commas, will enable them to take the fight to the Tories on issues like the NHS and schools and all
that. So they actually imagine that getting Brexit done will just not be of any significant benefit to the Tories.
They
and then go, well,
will...
let's just forget that ever happened. Level playing field, let's just do other issues. Like,
they think it will take the poison out. And this is also the argument that people like Rory Stewart put forward. It will take the poison out of British politics, and it will enable us to focus on different kinds of policy. That is their thinking.
Different kinds of poison.
Different policies, even.
I do think, I mean, it is mad. It really is a mad thing to just get behind, and even just the amount of blame you will take, you will be known for all time on this thing. Because the other important thing for MPs to remember is the fact that this deal is not going to be a popular deal for very long. You know, you look in... I mean, it's not very popular now. Even now, most people asked about it in the snap poll that YouGov put out. Even though most people in that poll suggested that MPs should pass it, most of them already thought it was a bad deal. A big majority for don't know. Like, no one is going to... In 2 years' time, no one is going to be praising this deal that, you know, carves up Britain. And when they realise that there's years more of this fucking talk, especially with new artificial timetables, and we're still talking about no deal in, like, fucking 12 months' time, no one's going to be happy about this thing. And your name will be attached in a way that it isn't if you're a Tory MP. If you're a Tory MP, you went with the herd, you went with the flow. If you stood out as a Labour guy and helped Boris Johnson get his deal across the line, that shit is not going to go down well for you. So it is astonishing to me that just on the most selfish of assessments, they are still there considering that they might do it.
Johnson has managed to reframe the debate very successfully, though, to present it as bad as no deal is the alternative to his deal, and to rephrase Theresa May, bad deal is better than no deal. And we all have to admit that bad deal is better than no deal, however much we loathe bad deal.
Shouldn't Labour, though, in order to minimise the damage to the whole party, be very firm about withdrawing the whip from anyone who supported the deal? Because they seem to go... I keep reading... Twitter basically drives me mad because it's constantly, like, political reporters going, I've just been told. Update. Like, everything's just like, no, not that, now this. Remember with the DUP, where it's just like, DUP have gone for it. No, they haven't. Yes, they have. No, they haven't. Yes, they have. No, they haven't. And it's the same thing with this removing the whip thing. But surely it's extremely wise for the leadership to go, well, look, we can't literally... strong-arm you and march you through the right lobby. But we can at least go, there's going to be a real penalty, because if those handful of Labour MPs swing it, you say, obviously, very bad for them personally. But then if they're not sufficiently censured by the leadership, again, massive Lib Dem attack line is the leadership doesn't care. The leadership let them do it.
I'm not comfortable with that. I sort of don't think that anyone should have the whip withdrawn on this issue. I mean, I wasn't comfortable about it with the purge Tories. I'm not comfortable about it now. I think it's different if you're saying, right, you can't sit in the front on the front bench. That's a sort of a different matter.
Right.
But I can see how it's a moment of conscience, and especially if your constituents are one way and you're another. I don't really think we need strong on. But anyway, I would also suggest there's already an incentive there just because of the kind of noises from Momentum, which, you know, suddenly we're fucking... I mean, Jesus Christ, the weird bedfellows. I'm waking up in the morning and just horrified by this. Like, oh, the DUP, Nigel Farage and Momentum are our new allies. It's like some kind of what hellish world have we landed in. But nevertheless, they're basically saying, look, we will fuck you up if you do this thing. And I think that sort of has that at least some sort of penalty that I think is probably more severe than the stuff that they're getting from the leadership.
I appreciate the point of principle you're making. I think I've just become quite... I've obviously become brutally pragmatic and illiberal on this one. I was like, no, I suppose it is bad if you withdraw the whip, but on the other hand, destroy them. this is what Brexit does to us.
New politics.
Yeah. So there's another issue, of course, was the hope that a confirmatory referendum would be sort of tagged onto the bill, but then there's a whole... Again, we have a whole numbers issue. Is there any likelihood that there would be people that would only go over the line with a few people, you know, with a few people, if the confirmation referendum was tagged on? Is it kind of like arithmetically likely?
Well, I think if Johnson loses his vote, there will be quite a few people saying that he should have attached a confirmatory referendum to it, because then he would have got it through, because I think he would, no question, almost no question, if he had. People like Hillary Benn even might have considered voting for it, you know. So, yeah, I think if he loses it, that may come to be seen as a mistake. But I think the chances of it happening now, although Ian will be more plugged into what is going on in the Commons, minds of the Commons, than I am, are small.
Yeah, I mean, it's not happening. I mean, they're not going to put it on before the deal. Everything is about after. You know, maybe there would be one. You know, if the deal is voted down, maybe there would be one. And even this, I think is a slightly fantastical idea that even if it was passed, and they might try and chuck something onto the Queen's speech or onto the legislation to pass the deal to do it. And I just think, no, if this thing was to get through on a meaningful vote, then I kind of think that stuff is probably going to be dead. I mean, you fight the fight because you've got to go for it. But I think the chances there will be pretty slim. And the reason they backed down was because they didn't think that they had the numbers. So they sort of thought, well, look, it makes us, you know, it creates a momentum around our defeat ahead of the thing. And what we really need to do is to defeat this deal. You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. To me, it makes much more sense to attach it. But, you know, what makes sense to me and what makes sense to the fucking House of Commons are two very distinct things.
You mentioned earlier we wanted to talk more about what was going on with Oliver Letwin, so yeah, let's do that.
It's not a phrase you hear very often.
No.
I mean, the main news today to me seems to be bafflingly under-discussed, which is this amendment that Oliver Letwin has put forward that basically sort of tries to course-correct what was in the Benn Bill, of basically saying, well, look, this is all on a meaningful vote, to go, actually, this is all on the legislation. So what it does is it says, look, we're not actually going to vote on this today. It will be attached to the thing tomorrow, because we're not actually really going to vote on this. We're just going to recognise it's been here, and we will make our call when the legislation is published. So then, because the Benn Act still counts, October 19th date still kicks in. Extension is then asked for and received, we expect. And we would not know what was happening until the legislation was published. Now, that makes a really big difference, because A, it buys time. At the moment, you notice the way that momentum was what was working for Boris Johnson. Momentum and lack of details. You could just pummel it through. Get it done. Don't worry about the details. The more that you see the details come out, the more you see the ERG talking about the new cliff edge versus, you know, what the purge Tories would think, the more difficult it becomes for him, because the innate trade-offs of it become clearer. So this is quite an interesting move. It also, by the way, means that we could get to tomorrow. It's actually quite likely. We'll get to tomorrow, and then the first vote that happens, you're like, oh, turns out there's nothing going on today. Which is going to be quite a fucking, like, it's going to be quite a denouement to the whole thing, which would be odd. But it would, I think, be very, very positive, because it buys time to scrutinise and it buys time to highlight the divisions that are currently being passed over by him. Now, the names on that are interesting. Oliver Letwin, going to vote for a deal, supporting it. And Philip Hammond, I think, supporting it. There, to me, it seems quite plain that there is a majority in the Commons for that thing. You've got to assume the opposition parties get behind it. But when guys like that, who would otherwise vote for the deal, are prepared to do it, there's at least a potential majority, and I think a real one. I think there's a very, very good chance it'll pass, and that will completely change the dynamics of this whole thing.
One thing that a lot of people might be wondering about in all this kind of typhoon of news is, if the deal is passed, God forbid, are we leaving the EU on the 31st of October, or is it going to take a technical extension?
We are leaving on the 31st of October. However, we will be in a transitional sort of period after that. And for example, if you want to, for any reason whatsoever, to move to the EU and settle there, you have, I think, until the end of December 2020 to do so. After that, you basically can't anymore. So there's various things will continue as was for a while, but then they will change.
But what I mean is the October 31st deadline is not going to be bumped back into November, because there was talk of...
It might be a little bit. I mean, it might be a couple of weeks, because they've got the legislation here, they've got the legislation in the European Parliament, you're talking a couple of, you know, basically, everything starts happening very quickly. It would be very, very, very fucking bad. I am genuinely anxious now. Like, last night, I actually was struggling to sleep. There's like a podcast I listen to where it's just these two kind of stoner American intellectuals talking about shit like yo-yos and baths or whatever. And I'm almost hypnotically unable to get to the end of one of those podcasts. Like, as soon as their voices come on, I fall asleep. And last night, I was like, I've just got to the end of this fucking podcast. Like, how is that? I must be actually quite whatever. So,
We got used to it not happening. We got used to that anxiety, I remember, around May's deal. And it just got to the point of just like, it's not happened again. Brexit hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Boris Johnson's been defeated in the Commons, you know, six times in a row or whatever. And he kind of got used to this just this ongoing kind of like, not that we're winning, but they're not winning either.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is the first time in ages where it's actually kind of moved to something.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was almost hoping that they were going to because of the no deal thing, that was a much easier thing to battle. Because it's such a nightmare, and hence you get the, you get the Benn Act. Whereas this deal, it's just so kind of, it is seductive to certain people that just want to go, let's just get it out of the way.
Mm.
And that's, I suppose, why I'm sort of anxious for the first time in a long time. Because you can understand that appeal in a way that I could never, there's no part of my brain that understands the appeal of no deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I get why some people would just go.
You know, that sense as well that we only ever have to lose once, you know. Like, they have to lose so many times. Yeah. Even if you lose it, you still have to lose an election. You know, after they have to lose this vote, they then have to lose an election after that, and then they have to lose the referendum. You know, there's like all these things that have to happen for us to win. And on any of these, it's just as soon as it comes down to it, we only have to lose once. And so you just get brought down. I always have this sort of image in my mind of like the defences. And I was sort of like, well, defence one was like the EU would never sign up to this stuff. Defence two was like the DUP wouldn't support it. Defence three is like when you get to the, you know, having a referendum on the legislation. And defence four was like the vote on it. And it was like, apart from the DUP one, all those defences fell. And of course, for Dan, you're just sitting there going like, oh, fucking hell, I'm not feeling so great about this right now. And I'm pretty much still in that space.
And we should just before we sort of wrap up, I just want to talk about another depressing thing. Roz, do you... another depressing thing. I could have done yo-yos, but I'm going to go for this instead.
Okay.
Roz, if Boris Johnson gets the deal through, then there's an election. He's the guy that, you know, did it by October 31st. And brought, he could actually say, brought people together and all that lot.
He will.
And there are some Labour MPs, and therefore this sort of, you know, shit attaches to Labour. And you get many angry Remainers. And of course, there'll be angry Remainers, you know, anyway, thinking of, well, if you'd had different leadership, different people in the leadership office, et cetera, et cetera. Is it basically pretty much nailed on that the Tories would then win the next election?
I think it's pretty likely. Because and they, there is no way that we would even got to this stage in the process had we had a decent opposition, I believe. But we not in that situation. We have Corbyn, who is unpopular with the electorate, full stop. And I don't think that's going to change, unfortunately. However, there is still a lot to fight for, even if we don't run. Even if we can't run people on a explicitly Remain ticket and Remain pacts in individual constituencies, we can still try and create a better result through those kinds of pacts. That's still possible. We can still create a more, I would say, balanced parliament. It will be fucked up by FP, the first person post, but... Yeah, there is still a lot to fight for. It will feel like if he wins his vote, it will feel terrible, and it will be a hard thing to get over. But you've got to take it to the next fight. You've got to regroup, and then you've got to think, right, there's so much to take on, so much to fight at the moment. Like Johnson himself to be exposed. Yeah. His ability to deceive will not continue forever. He will eventually, the shine will go off. And there are so many issues at the moment in national politics and international politics that are still to fight for. And this will be a setback if we lose. Well, if we lose. But we can regroup, and there are many, many fronts on which we can fight. And I don't altogether rule out, in the end, deciding to rejoin the EU, as Donald Tusk even hinted at. I don't rule that out. I don't think we should write off that possibility completely.
No, of course. No, I mean, these are all things that we should talk about after we know what's sort of happened on Saturday. But, of course, there is going to be a massive protest march on Saturday, which we will all be at, and hopefully
I'll be in Parliament.
Oh, yeah, yes.
But I'll wave to you guys from my office window.
Yes, but I've got, like, a dummy version of you.
Oh, cool.
Which I'm going to put on just a stick.
When did you make that? That's quite freaky.
I've been making it ever since the show started. It takes a very long time. It's eerily accurate, handcrafted. It's got a little... You pull the string on the back, it laughs like you.
Oh, wow.
It's really unsettlingly beautiful work of art.
That's really scary. That's like some sort of Guy Fawkes thing. You don't want any leavers to get hold of it, or they'll throw you on a bonfire.
So, yes, all of us except real Ian will be there. And what if the bad news comes in while we're on the march? Firstly, is that likely in terms of parliamentary procedure? Is it likely to come around sort of lunchtime?
It's not. It probably would have been because the government was trying to, you know, not content with only allowing 2 days to look at it. It wanted like basically an hour and a half to debate it. And that was your lot, mate. But there was an amendment passed yesterday which stopped that from happening. We'll allow it to go on longer. So we have basically no idea when that thing is going
to happen. Probably get to do the march before we actually find out what's going on.
Yeah, my guess is there'll still be a bunch of people in the streets, but we won't be at the most marchy part of the march by the time that it comes in.
Probably be Michael Heseltine up there.
And how do we keep our morale up, Roz?
Oh, well, it's tough. Loud music, cold swims. Loud music and cold swims.
I don't think there's any cold swims on the march, but there is loud music.
Well, you could always throw yourself in the Thames. No, I mean, I'm not advocating that. But there's loud music. And I love that thing when the march is when you get that kind of wave thing. I think they have it in football stadiums, but I've never actually been to a football match, so I don't know if they really do or not. But when everyone starts going, yeah, and then it kind of rolls back through the crowd, it's incredibly exhilarating, isn't it?
And the sounds, are you describing a Mexican wave?
Yeah, I probably am, actually.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
And you show, I haven't actually been to any raves either. I'm just not familiar with these.
It's not Mexican raves. That's very different.
They don't do that in raves. It's not a bunch of people on pills. No, but there's a sound system. Coordinate that degree.
There's an amazing sound system lineup where the DJ changes like every 8 minutes or something. I've never seen a lineup like it because there's so many people that want to play, and it's like Ed Chemical, friend of the show, is playing, and he's almost just sort of like catch me at. I'm probably misremembering this here. From 2 p.m. to 8 minutes past two. And it's just like two tunes or one long one and next. But there's an amazing kind of... there is an amazing amount of energy into it. And I just feel like just celebrate that moment, that kind of period, celebrate the experience, this huge sort of coming together.
Yeah.
Which also represents the culmination, I think, of all these other marches and all the enormous amounts of activism and... efforts, people like obviously Naomi's been the real, hero on that front, and it just feels like it would be an awful shame to not go, or to go, and be sort of pre-defeated.
Or be insane not to go. I mean, this
it's so important to be there, and it also is, again, whatever happens with the vote, it also shows, a strength of feeling in the country, and one of the things I really. Hate when people talk about the Iraq War March. They go, well, it didn't change anything. It's like, it did. It has a huge legacy. Mm-hmm. We're still talking about it. It didn't literally stop the Iraq War, but then marches tend not to stop wars if the public and MPs want one. But we're still talking about it. It had a huge effect. Tony Blair is still being asked about it. Like, it represented a huge strength of feeling. There were activists, there are activists working now that were formed in Occupy. Mm-hmm. There will be people with whatever happens to Extinction Rebellion who will go on to do really important, useful things. Like, you just kind of have to go. I've seen a couple of friends, on social media, rather kind of downcast, like it's all over. And it's like, it really isn't, and it certainly isn't all over by the time you're going to be marching down there with like hundreds of thousands of people mm-hmm. on Saturday lunchtime.
I mean, look, and before that, by the way, I mean, to be downcast today is crazy. The first thing you should be doing today is writing to MPs. And if by any chance your MP is one of those wobbly Labour ones, or frankly, even if they're an ERG guy and you want to start writing to them and going like, by the way, these are the things that you said about Ireland, about Britain, blah, 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 then do the job. I mean, right now, there's still stuff to play for, so you gun it hard. Mm. And even afterwards, like you said about the connections that you make, part of the important stuff around protest movements and all that are the people that you meet and the networks that you form. Now, if we were to lose, which is very, very, very far away from a far-gone conclusion right now, we don't know that. But if we were to lose, those networks are going to prove completely crucial in the months and years to come, because that will be the first line of defence against one of the most right-wing moments in this country's history, and we will need them regardless of anything else that's going on. So, yeah, we can be downbeat on Sunday if we lose for one day, but for the time being, fucking get to work, man.
Well, that's the end of the show. We'll definitely be back on Wednesday. We may well be back with another emergency podcast before then. Until then, like Ian says, get to work.